How can we go about achieving lasting social and political change? How much war must we visit upon ourselves before we recognize that war does not work? As the last living leader of the civil rights movement and an American hero to many, Congressman John Lewis continues to work toward building a better world. He was a key player in the struggle to end segregation, a campaigner and friend to presidential candidate Bobby Kennedy until his assassination, a confidant to Martin Luther King Jr., whose vision and efforts Lewis carried on to subsequent generations, one of the 13 original Freedom Riders, and an eyewitness to the many momentous occasions in American history over the last 50 years of working in public service. Despite being rejected, hated, and jailed, and even after being witness to betrayal, corruption, and conspiracy, Congressman Lewis believes that people can work together toward lasting social change and asserts that worldwide change can be achieved through nonviolent means. In his inspirational new book, Across That Bridge, Congressman Lewis shares his life story, the lessons he learned as one who dreamed, worked, and struggled in America's last revolution, and describes the work he believes is necessary to move the country forward. It is a great pleasure to welcome Congressman John Lewis to our program. Sir, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. I'm delighted and very pleased to be with you this morning.
The book, it is, a delight to have you here. The book is broken up into several key sections: faith, patience, study, truth, peace, and love. These are all terms and are all ideals that you believe that we need to have these life lessons if we are going to change anything.
I believe 50 years ago that if we hold on to certain basic principles and ideas that we could succeed, that you must have faith. You must believe and never, ever get lost in a sea of despair. And you have to find a way to do what I call get in the way. When I was growing up in rural Alabama and would see those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored waiting, I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, and great-grandparents, why? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in trouble. Don't get in the way. But I was deeply inspired by the action of Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. And at a young age, I met Rosa Parks, met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and got involved in the movement. But before getting involved, I studied. Like so many other young people, we prepared ourselves. We studied the philosophy of nonviolence. We studied passive resistance. We studied what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he accomplished in India. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience, and we began to accept the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living. And these lessons have been very good for me, and that's why I'm still hopeful and so optimistic today about the future.
You look at the point that you make, which is that social transformation starts from within. Before we change anything, we have to get this right within ourselves. And you did this during your many struggles. And what was fascinating to me, and I guess I knew this, but I didn't realize it, of just how young you were. You were just in your teens and in your early 20s when you were going about this. How much of that comes from your character and how you were brought up?
Well, I was imbued by my elders, my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, to believe and not to become bitter, not to become hostile, and try to do good, treat people right, and be kind, and never, ever say an evil word to anyone and try not to mistreat anyone. And that was really became part of my makeup. So when I started studying the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, It was very easy to accept that way of peace. And it became, I would say, part of my being that I would not do something that would try to get back to someone or get even with someone, but I would just keep my mind stand on what I believed in. I believed in what was right and fair and just and in the truth. And I thought in some way and somehow these goals and would win out, would prevail.
Why do you believe that we are so quick to go to war as opposed to having this process within us and trying to seek peace first?
It is human nature. It is the nature of humankind to be so eager and anxious to strike out at our fellow human beings, our fellow humankind. And we should think, we should have an executive session with ourselves as individuals, but as a nation, as a people, and say war is not the way. Violence is not the way. War begets war. Violence begets more violence. And in the end, we have to be willing to create and move toward the creation of a beloved community, of a beloved world. The way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence is a much better way. Dr. King was said to us in many of the meetings, in many of the workshops, and when he spoke, he would say, we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will perish as fools. We have to come to that point where we truly believe that war is messy. It is bloody. It destroys the hopes and dreams of a people. And there's a better way. And the only way to peace is peace itself.
At the March on Washington, your speech was considered by many to be the most radical. Again, you're just 23 years of age. And when you say, we will not be patient, and you look at the things that you put forward in this book, how patient ultimately should we be?
As a people, as individuals, we have to take the long, hard look that a struggle to redeem our own selves and to redeem a community, to redeem a nation, or to redeem a world, is not a struggle that lasts for a few days or a few weeks or a few months or one lifetime. It is a struggle of many lifetimes. But you can have a sense of righteous indignation, and you can say, like I said in the speech on August 28, 1963, you tell us to wait, you tell us to be patient, but we cannot be patient. But you have, in the truest sense, you have to be prepared to look down that long path, down that long road, and be hopeful, be optimistic that you will overcome, that you will survive. And in the process, there may be setbacks. There may be some interference. Some of us may be beaten, arrested, or jailed. Some of us may die. But you must continue to be committed to that immutable principle of nonviolence and the idea of peace.
You were beaten. You were physically beaten in South Carolina. You served 40 days in jail at the Parchman Farm prison in Mississippi. How do you look at that and say that helped in some way? Because that helps the movement as a whole, I assume, but it also helps you personally.
But my being beaten in South Carolina, in Montgomery during the Freedom Ride 51 years ago, and on the bridge in Selma 47 years ago, I think did help the struggle, did help the movement. But it helped me. It made me a stronger and better human being. It gave me something to hold on to. And so when I go to South Carolina, I visit Montgomery, I visit Selma, I'm always reminded that in these places I gave a little blood, and others gave a little blood, and some gave more than a little blood. They gave their very lives. But one of the most amazing things, I should say, experience that came out of South Carolina, my seatmate, a young white gentleman, the two of us arrived in South Carolina at the little town of Rock Hill at the Greyhound bus station on May 9, 1961, and a group of young men beat us and left us lying in a pool of blood. And the police officials came up and said, "Did we want to press charges?" We said, "No, we believe in peace. We believe in love. We believe in nonviolence." And 2 years ago, a month after President Barack Obama was inaugurated, one of the men that had attacked us came to my office in Washington and said, "Mr. Lewis, I'm one of the people that beat you." He came there with his 48-year-old son. And he said, "Will you forgive me? I apologize. Will you accept my apology?" And I said, "Yes, I forgive you." His son was with him. His son started crying. He had been encouraging his father to take the step. The father started crying. They both hugged me more. I started crying. And this man called me brother. I called him brother. And I've seen him four different times since then. That's what the movement was all about, to move toward the building of one family, one house, toward reconciliation.
I guess one of the things that I keep thinking about in reading your book and hearing you speak many times is that you look at what you went through, and not only do you have the emotional scars, but you have the physical scars of that beating on your body that you can look at. And the question is, why do we not, as a culture and a society, learn from that? Why do other people who are oppressed in some way having to fight? In other words, there are gay men and women across this country who are fighting for the right to marry. And yet, equality for the civil rights movement did not bring about equality for all. There are all kinds of people who are still oppressed, who are still fighting. And does everyone have to go through that fight and to have those scars for it to work and to come out of it? Or can't we just learn from one horrible chapter in our history that people should be equal?
Well, it is my hope that people would learn the lesson from this little book, that it's not necessary for us to cross another bridge or for people to be beaten. You're so right. There's still people that have been discriminated against, people that have been left out and left behind, and they're African-American, they're white-American, Latinos and Asian American, Native American, but gay people and straight people that have been discriminated against. And on the whole question of marriage equality, you know, at another time in our country, especially in the southern part, there was laws against interracial marriage. And even during the late 50s and early 60s, people would ask Dr. King, "What do you think about it?" And Dr. King would say, "Races don't fall in love and get married. Individuals fall in love and get married." And I take the position that I fought too long and too hard against discrimination based on race and color, not to be against discrimination based on sexual orientation. So if two men or two women fall in love and want to get married, it's their business. It should be their right. And we should tear down that barrier like here and now, and I think the day will come when we will look back on this period like we look back on the whole period dealing with race and laugh about it and say we were so silly. What was the fuss all about? Why did we fight so hard to keep people for an exercising their constitutional rights, whether they're based on race or based on gender.
When you look at the civil rights movement and the battles that you fought and the as you mentioned, the blood that was shed, you have to wonder at what point we come to that again, in the sense of, as a nation, when do we take to the streets and when do we say, all right, we don't feel as though we are equal. We don't feel that we are economically equal. We don't feel that we are socially equal. And there was a time and a place, and this gets into your patience, talking about patience earlier, where you say, you know, we're not patient anymore. You wonder if these different chapters in our history, where people don't rise up as they did in the 1960s, and say, okay, we've had enough. There seems to be an ambivalence. There seems to be I don't know if it's not caring or it's or what it is of how the mood is different, where people do not want to take the stand that you and your brothers and sisters took more than five decades ago.
Well, I think there come a time when people are inspired, or there's a spark, they're tracked down by what I call the spirit of history. Right now, I feel in America, and maybe in other parts of the world, that as a people and as a society, we're too quiet, and people need to push and pull and do what I call make some noise and find a way to get in the way. And as I said before, my folks told me over and over again, don't get in trouble, don't get in the way. But I was inspired to get in the way, to get in trouble, and I call it good trouble. Dr. King and Rosa Parks and Gandhi and so many other moving, unbelievable leaders and individuals and ideas inspired me, and people need to be inspired again. And it's my hope that this book will be a little guide to set to people that you can do it, you can push, you can be transformed, and you can find a way through following these lessons and helping to transform the larger society. But we first must transform ourselves. And before we went on any sit-in, any freedom ride, any marches, we studied in Nashville, Tennessee as a student. Every Tuesday night, a group of us, black and white college students and some high school students, for more than a school year, until we accepted the way of peace, the way of love, the way of nonviolence as a way of life, as a way of living.
You speak to a lot of young people at a lot of commencements, young men and women who are getting ready to enter the workforce and make a change. There is so much pressure upon them to go out and get jobs and concern among them that they have incredible loans to pay and they have to be able to pay them off and get a job that will do that. Your message to those graduates seems to be different in the sense of just make yourself a better person first.
Well, I've been saying to several graduations during the past few days, And I said to students all the time, elementary, middle school, high school, college students, young people all over, that find a way to become a little more human. Be kind. Don't become bitter. Don't become hostile. Have faith. It's better to love than to hate. And find something that is so precious, so dear, so necessary, that you're prepared to give your very life for. If young people accept that body of ideas, they will make it. They will survive. And in the process, whether they become a college professor, a lawyer, a doctor, a politician, or whatever, a journalist, whatever, they will bring a little more humanity to whatever they do. I think it's a great need in our country and a great need in the world to humanize our world, to humanize our country, to humanize our institutions.
The book is Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and a Vision for Change. It is written by Congressman John Lewis. Representative Lewis, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here and what an honor it is to speak to you, and how much I appreciate all the work and everything that you have done for this country. It's such a great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be talking with you today.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Across That Bridge, Life Lessons and a Vision for Change by Congressman John Lewis. It's published by Hyperion. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.